Welcome to Storyline Podcast.
Let's bring stories to life.
I think I have like almost 24 influences or little things that I borrowed from, whether they're the Chinese mountain paintings or the Goodnight Moon fireplace is there, or the laundry is from Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. I love children's books, and I was kind of putting in my love for the history of children's books into this book. So if anybody can find all 24 things in Yes and No, I will send them one of my cats. And I'm joking about that.
Hi, you're listening to Storylines Conversations with children's books authors and illustrators around the world. I'm your host, Ella.
Today, I have on the podcast with me, an author and illustrator who has won the 2018 Caldecott Honor for the book he wrote and illustrated, Big Cat, Little Cat. It seems to be a very simple story with only black and white pictures, but my eyes were full of tears by the end of my first reading. And his name is Elijah Cooper. Before we started to record, Elijah was very excited to take out the Chinese edition of Big Cat, Little Cat and told me that it was his favorite edition. And in this episode, we mainly talked about his latest work, a book that freshly came out this April, Yes and No. He told me that when he was creating this book, he spent lots of time at the Impressionist galleries and looked at a lot of Asian art collections. And again, this seemingly simple story has very deep emotions. It is a book that both children and adults would enjoy. Without further ado, now let's dive into our conversation.
Hi, I'm Elisha, and nice to be talking with all of you. I live in New York City with my family and two very big, lazy cats who I draw and I write about. I wrote about them in my book, Big Cat, Little Cat, and I'm sort of writing about them again in this new book called Yes and No, which is actually about a cat and a puppy. And the puppy is kind of modeled after the dog I had growing up when I was a kid on a farm. And he's kind of this irrepressible, rambunctious puppy who just wants to do everything and then he sort of gets in trouble. And that's sort of the story of this new book.
The first time I saw this book, it makes me feel very familiar. I immediately thought about Big Cat, Little Cat from the cover. They have kind of similar style. And unlike most of your books, which are done with watercolors and a lot of colors, this book has a little bit more color than Big Cat, Little Cat, but you use very simple strokes to draw the characters. I was just wondering, like, why did you choose pink as the color of the cover?
Yeah. So, no, you really caught on to something there, because most of my books, and I've done like 25 books, most of my books are in pencil and watercolor, and they're kind of a bit more fluid about, you know, rivers and trains and farms. But for Big Cat, Little Cat, I did it in ink, black ink, because it was kind of a serious subject. It was about a cat who dies and a new cat who comes, and I wanted it to be kind of pure and simple and almost like calligraphy. And I really enjoyed working with ink. And so for this new book, I wanted to do ink again, but because it was a lighter story about a rambunctious puppy, I decided to kind of almost meld the two, join the two of ink and watercolor. And so it's because no animal dies in this book. It's more upbeat book. There's some sadness to it because the puppy has to come in at the end of the day, but I wanted to kind of join ink and watercolor. And the reason I kind of went with pink is I actually have an Italian can of tuna on my desk, which is a beautiful pink. And I looked at this pink and it has blue lettering. I liked how pink and blue work together. So for Big Cat, Little Cat, I was working with yellows. And here I just kind of liked this pink. It just seemed to look to be about sunrise. And then the blue is about midnight. And so the color almost kind of informs the book. And also my youngest daughter has a pink blanket. And there's a pink blanket, which figures prominently in this book. So I was thinking about pink for that reason too. She's had the pink blanket since she was a week old. So it's her old pink blanket. And now she's 16 years old.
Oh, that's sweet. My son actually has a pink blanket too.
There we go. Pink, everybody has a pink blanket.
After said that, I find these two colors are really great because for the end paper of this book, it's pink and dark blue, which shows the passage of time of the story. So it started from early morning to late at night. And then that's a very, very good design, I think. So for yourself, which page is your personal favorite?
I think my favorite might be the one, it's sort of towards the middle, towards the end, once the puppy's gotten in all sorts of trouble, and we, the narrator or the mother, we've sent this puppy and cat off into the field. And it's a wordless painting with just the puppy and the cat small walking up the hill, and they look kind of brave. And you see everything. You see the house, you see the trees, you see the pond, you see the hill they're climbing. And I kind of loved that painting because one of my favorite painters is Edward Hopper. So I was able to kind of have a Edward Hopper house. And then I also was able to make the fields look like My Neighbor Totoro, which is one of my favorite movies. And I also, as they come up into the field, I have them walking around a rock which is from my Blueberries for Sal. So there are all these kind of references that I put into that painting. And I just kind of like it because it looks, you're kind of looking down on them, but not quite. And they just look kind of peaceful. And I think that's my favorite painting. And I had a lot of fun painting that one too. And so I made prints of that one. And that's the one that I'm going to put up on my wall, that painting.
I think my favorite page is also a wordless page. It's the one that the cat and the puppy, they finally climbed up to the top of the hill and stand side by side. And then looking afar at all those mountains, skies, clouds. Even though we cannot see their faces, I could feel the emotions like floating in the air. And it's like, all of a sudden, it's like there's music in the background. And I could feel the breeze of the wind. And that also reminds me of some traditional Chinese art and also Japanese animations. For you as a Western artist, but I can feel this kind of oriental influences in your artwork. Is it really related?
Yeah. Yeah, they're all kind of wrapped up because when I was thinking about this book, I live in New York and I would go up to the Met, and I was really inspired by going to the Impressionist galleries, and I was looking at Pizarro and a lot of the Impressionists like Cezanne, and I was looking at what they did with clouds and shadows, and I was thinking about them. But after visiting those galleries, I went over to the Asian galleries, which have these beautiful long Chinese mountain scrolls, and I became very aware that the Impressionists, like Pizarro and Van Gogh, were aware of Chinese and Japanese paintings and were collecting them. They were collecting them in the 1800s, and you know, they were drawing cherry blossoms into their paintings. You know, they were very aware of what was going on. So there's this kind of cultural appropriation, but also kind of cultural appreciation for art going back and forth. And so I tried to do that with some of these paintings. It's in the background, almost having some French villages, but then they kind of meld into Chinese mountains with how they kind of stand up straight with fog rolling in or sunsets. And I kind of tried to make it. And I guess when this dog and this cat, who again get in all sorts of trouble, they go up, and I guess I wanted that moment to be with what you're talking about. I wanted them to kind of finally take a breath and see outside of themselves and see that the world was big, that the world is so big, and there are other places, there are other people, there are places that we can be curious about, and we can kind of settle in and wonder. We can wonder about the world. And so I don't know if they're looking off at Japan or China or not, even though I painted a little pagoda in those mountains, but it's just the sense of beauty. And you know, again, the world is wide, and I wanted them to calm down and feel the wind in their hair and feel that sense of wonder, which is what we kind of get when we read a good book, right? That sense of wonder. So they're almost traveling even though they're not.
Yeah, I think the readers can travel through your pictures as well.
Exactly. Yeah, the best books do that, right? We don't have to, because we're reading that, we're sitting at home, the book is in our lap, we're very much where we are. But a great book or a good book can kind of make you dream. And especially, you know, this little puppy, this little cat, who's sort of a stand-in for us, he's not going far. You know, they go 50 yards up a hill, but then his imagination can go much farther, right? And then it gets inside of him, and he's filled with love, and then he goes home, and then he wants to go out again, and he's really sad that his day is done. So there is something about how, yeah, books make us travel, and they make us want more, and they make us happy and sad at the same time, right? I think.
Yeah, exactly. That's a similar idea in your book, Magic Thinks Big, right?
I'm embarrassed that you're saying that, because it probably shows that all of my books are the same, which is probably because I have the same. It's true. I'm writing the same book. People have said that we all write the same book, and I think it's true because a lot of my books, even if they're about nonfiction, it's about exploring and about wonder and about thinking about going places, and then that wonderful feeling we have about going places, but then knowing that we can't and we want to go home again. You know, so yeah, I have the same themes. You're aware that I'm writing the same themes.
I think the recurring theme in your works, that means those are things that are important to you, that you really care about.
Yeah.
We might talk about those experiences that's really important in your life that influences your work. I know you grew up on a farm, as you said. Nowadays, I don't know, like a lot of kids grew up in a city that they might not really relate to the experience on farms. When I was young, I was born in the city, but my grandparents, they lived in the countryside. So each summer or winter vacation, I got to stay several weeks or months in their house. And to me, that was a very precious experience because I could go to the field. I could directly see all these plants and animals. But I noticed that not many of my classmates have such an advantage because some of them, all their relatives are just born and raised in the city. For you, how was this experience or connection with nature important to you?
No, and you're totally right about that. I think that, I mean, first of all, you're right also that I was really lucky to have this experience growing up on a farm with animals, and I had cats and dogs and goats. I milked my goats every morning, and so it was kind of wonderful. And so my appreciation for animals is always in me. But the other thing is, okay, so I'm talking from New York City, and there are huge buildings all around me, but there's also Washington Square Park just outside my window. And I can go in and, you know, the trees are blossoming and people are walking their dogs under the trees. And three blocks the other way is the Hudson River. And I will go for my run there in a few hours. And I'll look out and I'll see birds flying along that river. And I know that whales have come up the river even. And their fish. And so even in the biggest city, there are these little moments of nature, right? There's a hawk who likes to fly around above our building. And I love those moments. And I think that any kid or any of us can kind of find those moments of peace, even in a big city. I love cities too. You know, I like that bustle. But I find that we, within a city, it's surprising how often we can find nature and find peace. It's really hard, but it was something, you know, during COVID, I was very aware in New York of going with a friend out to the Rockaways, which is, it's still New York City, but the Rockaways are the beach here in New York. And we went swimming all year. And it was a place to be distant, socially distant and safe, but it was to experience nature. And I think a lot of people are kind of hungering for that sense of nature. And, you know, again, that comes back to a book, like, you know, we read this book inside, but it kind of makes us want to get outside, you know? And then we go back and forth between inside, outside, inside, outside. So I guess that there's just this tension between city, nature, beauty, inside, outside. I don't know if that answers your question, but for me, they all tie together. They all tie together.
The setting of the book, Yes and No, also includes inside and outside. I read this book for many times, even though it seems to be a very simple book. But each time I read it, I could always find something new from those little details. For example, after I read it for many times, I realized that the cat actually didn't sleep at night. Because from the book title page, the cat jumps in from the window while the dog was sleeping. That's why when the owner asked, did you have a good night's sleep? And the dog said yes, and then the cat said no. By the end of the book, they were kind of curling together, ready to sleep together, but on the last page, the cat just sneaks away from the window and jumps out of the house. I have the habit of taking off the cover to look at the bookcase. Before I read the book, I couldn't really understand why. What does the bookcase mean? It's a light blue color of an overview of the house and hill. But after I read it for several times, I realized that this is the map, the overview of where the cat and dog lives. And there's a little dot on the top of the mountain. That might be the cat.
I was thinking about
maybe the time it was right before the sunrise and it's still a little bit dark. The cat was standing there. By connecting all those things together, it's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, you're very perceptive to catch up on that. And I was really thinking about that because that the case is all in blue. And the blue is meant that to interact with the kind of the peachy pink cover. But the blue is meant to show kind of this night moon shadow where the cat is out hunting on the top of the hill, looking back at the house. And it was very important to kind of show that the cat goes out at night. And then I had to have the cat sleep during the day a few times. I had her sleep up in the tree and she's sort of lounging around because, right, she leaves at night and goes hunts. Oh, I'm so glad that you noticed that because one of the things I was trying to do with this book is that, you know, it's called Yes and No. And on the face, it's simple, right? The puppy is yes, the cat is no. But I was trying to make it more complicated because I think children's books at their best, they appear simple, but they're actually pretty complicated. And so things kind of shift because at the end of the book, right, the puppy's saying no because he doesn't want to come in and the cat doesn't talk anymore. And then it goes back to the original. But I really am playing with a lot of things that I'm not showing explicitly. So again, I'm trying to, you know, show the cat going off on her own. The phrase even yes and no is not just oppositional. It's not just yes and no. At some point, the puppy is saying yes and no because it's both, right? Did the puppy have a good day? Mm-hmm. Yes and no, right? It's almost about ambiguity. Yeah. About ambiguity. It's like, it was both, right? So it's not just good or bad or hungry or not hungry. It actually gets a bit more complicated. And so I think that actually gets to what it is to be a kid or even a human. It's like, it's complicated, you know, it's complicated to have a day or to worry or to have feelings. And that's kind of what I was trying to get across is that it appears simple, but it's not simple.
Have you read this book to any kids or your daughters?
Yeah, well, my daughters are, you know, 16 and 18 and they could care less. They're reading other things and off to college. And I did read the books to them when they were younger. But I've started to read it to kids, and I'm really happy that they kind of get it. The kids that I've seen who I've read this book to get it. I think, on the first read, it's about the humor. There's this kind of troublesome puppy who doesn't know what to do with himself. But I think that I hope that the kids are understanding who read the book kind of get this, the kind of the pathos. If that's the right word, this kind of like, you know, sadness almost and, you know, resolution that you have to kind of come to terms with wanting so much in the world and you can't get it all and then you have to come home. But then being home is nice. You know, it's a little confusing, right? You know, it's I think what we all feel at the end of the day, a little tired, a little apprehensive, a little lost, a little found, you know. I don't know. That's what I was trying to get across, that kind of feeling at the end of the day of going, oh, it was such a good day, but I'm so sad, but I'm looking forward to tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I always feel that at the night.
Yeah.
I hope kids are getting that.
In this book, the cat and dog are very different. They have very different personalities. So right. In English, I think there's also a term to describe people like dog person and cat person, right?
Right.
You think you are more like a cat person or a dog person?
Oh, I'm more of a goat person, which is a goat person is somebody who just leaps all over the place and yells. No, I don't know which I am. I think, and that's the thing, is I think I'm both. And that's, in a way, what I was trying to get across here is that we sort of identify with the puppy, right? Because the puppy is the rambunctious one. He's the one who's saying yes, 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 yes. And the cat's just going, humph. You know, but I think, you know what, I think we have that in all of us at different times during the day. We are enthusiastic as readers, as kids, as adults. You know, we really want things. And then sometimes we just like, I can't be bothered. No, I'm going to go off by myself, right? And so in some ways, to get a little deep here, this puppy and this cat is the same person. It's actually sort of the same person in us, where sometimes we want so much. We want. We're yes people, right? And then sometimes we're just like, no, I don't want. I just want to, right? So it is about two different kids, but in a weird way, it's about those two emotions within us. I think that, so I'm both, in other words, to answer your question, I'm both a dog person, like wildly enthusiastic and over the top sometimes. And then I'm also I can be a very grumpy cat person too. What are you? Are you a cat or a dog person?
Like you said, it's a mixture of both dog and cats. Like, yeah. And I think when we were younger, we were more like a dog person. And as we grew older, we
right.
might pick up a little bit more from the cat personalities.
And I think that's why actually in this book, it's mostly about the puppy, because it's mostly our response as a kid is a bit more enthusiastic. And that's why the puppy is kind of front and center. And the cat is a little bit like the sidekick. And that's why, in a way, graphically, that's what I was trying to do too. You know, the puppy is the one that I painted in cream, and it's light, and it's kind of bigger and rounder. And the cat's much more of like a kind of a sinewy black kind of calligraphy apostrophe in the back of the painting, kind of commenting by just looking superior, you know? And I was really trying to play those things off each other, have the relationship graphically between, you know, the bigger, bolder dog and the kind of the more reclusive cat.
To you, I know this book much better, and I know that you actually have more allusions deliberately hidden in this book.
Yes.
I hope you could find out more.
You know, I think I gave a book talk about this, and I should put something online, but I have been talking on my Instagram site about the various influences I have in the book. I think I have like almost 24 influences or little things that I borrowed from, whether they're the Chinese mountain paintings or, you know, I put in Cezanne's apples all when the puppy is spilling apples all over the kitchen. Those are apples from a Cezanne painting. But I also put in, you know, from Goodnight Moon, the Goodnight Moon fireplace is there. Or, you know, the tree is from Ferdinand, or the laundry is from Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, you know, where Max is getting in trouble and pulling laundry off of a line, you know, and so I have the puppy pulling laundry off of a line, you know, so there are all sorts of little things that I tried to bury in the book, almost, because, you know, I think we all love children's books, and I love children's books, and I was kind of putting in my love for the history of children's books into this book. I just had a lot of fun just burying little things. So if anybody can find all 24 things in Yes and No, I will send them one of my cats. And I'm joking about that. I will not send my cats.
Talking about that, did you love reading as a kid? Well, were there any books that you still remembered that influenced you a lot, children's book?
No, I did. I love two things. First of all, I grew up on a farm and I loved sports. I played a lot of football growing up, a lot of soccer, and I loved running around. But when I was done running around, I did love to read. And some of my favorite children's books are the ones I referenced here, especially Ferdinand, because Ferdinand is a good example of a bull or a kid, right, who just kind of wants to go up and read sometimes. And I loved how he would go up and read under that tree and go, he kind of went up to his little hill, just like in Yes and No. And so I feel that those or even Blueberries for Sal, where she goes off and goes up onto a hill and finds peace kind of picking blueberries. So I was very aware of loving Blueberries for Sal and Ferdinand, both graphically in terms of black and white, but also for that sense of peace. I loved Microwave for Ducklings. I loved In the Night Kitchen by Sendak. I love a lot of books. And I also, one of the things that's kind of great about children's books is there are so many great books now that I've been loving. I mean, I was talking before about my friend Brian Floca's Locomotive, which is a beautiful book to me about exploring and about the outside. And Sophie Blackall's Hello Lighthouse is another beautiful book. There's so many books now that I love that are inspiring to me. So I feel that I was a reader when I was a kid, and even now I'm probably even more of a reader. I love reading nonfiction and novels. And if you could look around my apartment, you would see bookshelves everywhere, because I have books everywhere, and they're too many to mention. I feel like I could talk all day about my favorite books, right?
Is your love for books just comes naturally, or was that influenced by the family?
Definitely. My parents put books in my hands when I was 2 years old. I always had books around me. And I think, for me, so one of my good friends here in the city owns a bookstore, and I'm always over there. And books, both comes from being a kid and having books, but it even comes right now for me, it's just like, it's two things. One, it's like, I love holding a book in my hands. That's why it's so important for me to get the design right, because when you hold a book in your hands, you kind of fall in love if it has the right color or the right texture or the right paper. There are all these very important decisions that we make with a good book. And you know a bad book when you see it, because it's the paper's wrong or the color is a little off. But if you get the color right and you get the paper right, it almost feels great in your hands. And you go to a bookstore and you just kind of fall in love. And I love that feeling. So I'm just a huge fan of almost the physical nature of books. But then I think what's also great about books is, I'm thinking about this bookstore here in New York, is that, this is a place where people come together, right? And it's where people gather and kind of come together and they talk about books and then they go home with their books. And so it's kind of a way to be with other people and then by being alone again. And in a way, it's sort of like the metaphor of yes and no. It's like you want to be with people, you want all this stuff, and then you need to be alone. And so there's always that kind of push-pull with writing, I think, and with books, is that it's we want to be with people, and then we want our quiet space. And books, for me, do that. They're very public because we share something with other people when we read a book, but they're very private because we go off by ourselves or with our kid or our family, and we read by ourselves. But then we know we're reading a book that everybody else loves, and that's kind of a great feeling too. Again, there's this push-pull, Mm-hmm. It's such a communal act, a book, but it's such a private act too, right?
Exactly.
You see, very excited. I get very excited talking about books, you can tell. Because books are just wonderful. I love books. I love talking about books.
Because you mentioned that when you were young, your parents introduced the books to you, and then you become a parent. And how did you introduce the two your two daughters? And did you read to them every day? And then do you still talk about books nowadays?
Mm-hmm. So my daughter is taking a year off before going to college next year. And she just went on a trip down to Costa Rica, and she came back and we were talking about the 8 books that she brought down there. And I had such fun before she left kind of saying, okay, what are your 8 books going to be? Here's a book I loved. I loved, Jeffrey Eugenides' Middlesex, and she's read that and she loved that. And she loved this. And so she's traveling and she had these books with her. And she, we don't actually talk too much about the books, but I know that from when they were very young, putting books into their hands has made it so that when, again, she went on this trip, she brought tons of books with her. And she was reading with them, reading those books, and they were important to her. So I think that we just kind of, as parents or as teachers, when we put books into the hands of children, they will fall in love with them, and they will fall in love with first picture books, and then they will fall in love with chapter books, and then soon they will become adults like us, and they will go on trips and bring, you know, tons of books with them. That's my hope, right? And I think it's just really about access. It's just about access, so that we need to put books into kids' hands, and then they will fall in love, you know?
And I think one important thing is that for the parents or for the adults, they should love reading as well. Otherwise, if they ask the kids to read books while they are looking at the phones, and then that wouldn't be a very good example.
Totally. Yeah. No, I agree so much. And I also, what you're saying makes me think about why I feel that children's books are really important, and also really important to make smart and to make clever. And you were talking about all these kind of buried things in Yes and No, or the other allusions that I put into the book. And one of the reasons I'm doing that is to kind of entertain myself, but also to entertain parents, because I know if a book works, that book is going to be read 40 times and 50 times. And from being a parent myself, I know that if there was a bad book that my kids liked, and that happened, oh my God, I wasn't going to have to read this terrible book 40 times, and I was going to be bored to tears by this stupid, terrible children's book. And I don't want that to happen. I want to give a book to a parent where they can say, oh, I see the little joke going on here, or I can see the cat is going outside, or I can notice these little details, even these subliminal things that you might not understand about Chinese mountain paintings or the Impressionists. You know, I want to kind of give those to parents so they can say, I'm okay reading this 40 times. Because when we read kids' books so often to kids, it can be really annoying and boring over time. So you better give, we as authors, better give beautiful books that parents will fall in love with too. You know, that's my hope. Because at some point, it's no longer up to the parents, and the kids will choose their books. And kids don't have to read just beautiful books. They'll read trashy books too, and that's okay. But we want to give them kind of a basis of beautiful books. And I think that, again, starts with giving parents something that they want to read more than once.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the important thing for parents to let their child fall in love with reading is that they themselves fall in love with the children's books, so that when they are reading the books, they don't feel like they're teaching the, it's never the teaching kids to know the words, but to really appreciate everything in this great children's books. Yeah.
Yep.
That you love sports, and I know that you graduated from Yale. What was the most valuable thing that you've learned from your university? Because you majored in history, but now your occupation is not directly related to what you've learned. Mm. After so many years, what's the most important thing that you have left to you?
Oh, but you know what? It sort of is. Well, I'll tell you what. First of all, I went to Yale. But I was a very bad student. I mean, I was good enough to get into Yale, but once I went to Yale, I didn't study at all. I never got an A. I didn't care. And I was a very, very, very bad student. I played football. I spent most of my time playing sports, football, and avoiding my schoolwork. That's what I spent my time doing, and having fun with really smart friends. But I did love some classes, and one of the classes, some of the classes that I loved the most were actually taught by Jonathan Spence, who is like America's leading Chinese historian or historian of Chinese history. And one of the reasons I loved his classes, I don't even know if I did well in his classes, but I would go there into his lectures and listen to him tell stories about emperors and dynasties and a peasant uprising on all these types of things, and from the 1500s. And I would just sit in the dark and listen to him tell stories. And for me, history and nonfiction really is a way to kind of tell stories and fall in love and learn about the past. But kind of, it's really just about that feeling that of storytelling I loved his stories. And I'm embarrassed that I haven't, having studied Chinese history, that I haven't come to China yet, because I love these stories. And those stories, that storytelling is what books are, really, right? Even these small, somewhat simple stories about a cat and a dog. But there's other things that I've done about rivers or anything about nonfiction is about storytelling. And that came from my studying history at Yale, was this idea of how do we frame this event in such a way that we're like, oh, this revolution started with this one man. And it started with an ox, or it started on this river, you know, and you sort of, it became, there were these sticky little facts that we learned about. And I just love that about history and studying the world, that it was a way to explore. And so that way, in some ways, has stuck with me, you know. And so even though, yes, I was a really bad student at Yale, I think Yale gave me that appreciation for storytelling.
I think what you mean bad is just the main scores. I think when we value some person, we should not just using the scores to say good or bad. So in that case, you've learned.
Oh yeah, no, I was
something valuable.
But I was terrible. I was terrible. I never. So my wife, who is a professor, you know, she got good grades at Yale. I met her at Yale, and she's a professor now, and she got good grades, and I didn't. But I think that's because I just didn't study for the tests. And I didn't do well, but I read all the books, and I loved my talking with my smart students. But I was not I decided I was done with getting good grades. You know, there's so much pressure, and I was just like, I'm just gonna play with my mind, you know, and just learn from the people around me and not worry about being perfect anymore.
Yeah. I think people have different ways of learning. Some people are better at doing tests. Some others, they learn from. I think the most important for you is that you never stop learning.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I was always drawing stuff, you know. So I was drawing, and I always have kept a sketchbook with me, and so that part never left. And I, you know, from my first job and into writing books now, is that I've always been very curious, and I've always kind of read and written about the world. But the kind of that, I don't know, sometimes I worry about the pressure that we put on kids to be perfect in things. And I don't know, that's a longer conversation for another time, but that perfection worries me, because it sometimes takes us away from being curious and falling in love and not being so perfect, but being really inspired. But it's tough, because, you know, it's a different thing if you were in high school, where it's probably a good idea to do well in your school and be perfect. But then it sort of changes over time. You know, we don't always have to be so perfect as we move into adulthood. Some things can shift. But I don't know. I think that the thing that shouldn't shift is just being curious and being open to the world. And that means being a reader in some deep way, is always being open to learning new things and reading. That's kind of what's most important. I think when I kind of keep on talking about being a bad student, it's just like the grades don't matter anymore, you know? That's sort of what I'm saying.
I could totally resonate with that. And that case, I think that's universal, not just in the United States, also in China, students are under a lot of pressure.
Right.
Especially here, we have so many students, like, it's very competitive.
Yeah. I'm the father to two girls who put a lot of pressure on themselves to be excellent. So I understand that pressure, and, you know, and they should, because at this point they have to do well, you know, that's sort of their job as students. But I keep on wanting to give them books, right? And say, no, don't work so hard. Read this wonderful book. And they're like, Dad, I still have to study. And I'm like, of course they do. I know they do. But I think over time, they're going to remember that book that they fell in love with more than their math exam. Though that said, they could fall in love with math and, you know, they'll remember their math exams. We are all different as students, and how we fall in love is different, and what we fall in love with is different. I just happen to fall in love with art and books.
Were there any moments you feel challenged when you're creating your books?
Oh, every time, every day I feel challenged. And actually, I wrote about this, but my story for this yes and no book was that, so I should know better, but I made a huge mistake in this book. I I was painting on a different paper for Yes and No. I've painted the other 20 whatever books on Strathmore paper, which is made in Wisconsin. And for this book and for my book River, I started painting on this very fancy Italian paper called Fabriano Artistico. And I was painting on it and I was painting on it. And sometimes I was flipping the paper over and I didn't realize. And then the watercolor started behaving like mud. And some of my paintings came out wrong. And I was ripping up like half of my paintings. And everything was going wrong. Like I'd paint those, the puppy and the dog on the hill. And then I'd start with the watercolor and it would look, it was supposed to be a beautiful blue and it would kind of come out gray. And then I realized halfway, a month into painting the books, where some of the paintings were great and some of them were terrible, I realized that actually this fancy, fancy paper had two sides, the treated side and the untreated side. So very subtly, I couldn't even feel the difference, but I'd been painting some of the paintings on the untreated side. And so I should know better. You know, I've done a bunch of books. I should know this better, but I was messing up my paintings and I threw half of my paintings away. And when I realized what an idiot I'd been, I was so embarrassed. But so in other words, I think that happened, things like that happen all the time. Like, oh, I get the perspective wrong, or, oh, this is wrong. And I think the sooner we all realize that making books is kind of a messy process and it's imperfect, the better, because then we're kind of kinder to ourselves as artists. You know, I always like to, I mean, I'm surrounded here at my desk by all these books and they look perfect, or not perfect, but they are all put together. Here's the case, here's the jacket, here's the printed, it's all come together. But I try to remember that those books is just a collection of 50 paintings and their mistakes in the paintings that I correct, or their words that I have to edit to make better. And there's all this design that goes into making it work. And it's that messy design, which is kind of behind bookmaking, which I actually like that. And I think we as artists need to recognize that. So you're talking about, you know, the struggles or the mistakes that we make as artists. I think we make those mistakes every day.
I knew you wrote an essay about the suggestions on how to write good children's book. And,
oh, right. Yeah.
And you said, in fact, that's very inspiring. And you listed 10 suggestions, and at the end you said, don't listen to any of them because everyone's different. But we have so many students here. If you had to pick one suggestion, what would you choose?
I would say be kind to yourself and don't be so hard on yourself. And it comes back to what I was saying about perfection. And it's also about messiness in making books. Is I think that when I've seen students in art class try to draw, let's say, a dog, and it comes out wrong, they get frustrated and they rip it up. And part of that is okay, because you know what? You're supposed to get frustrated and you're supposed to keep on drawing the dog until it looks better, right? So you have to work hard. If you were a human, you have to work hard. You have to keep on drawing that puppy. But at some point, you can't beat yourself up if the puppy doesn't look perfect. You have to kind of be nice to yourself. So it's a little bit of both. So I'm not just saying, oh, draw the puppy, and if it looks like a cow, that's okay. No, keep drawing it. So I'm both saying work hard, but then I'm also saying take a deep breath and be kind to yourself. So in a way, it's sort of the message of yes and no. You know, it's like go hard at something, really go for it. But then at some point, take a breath, you know, and I think that's my advice to people is like, I'm not saying that we should all just be running off in the fields with flowers and not caring about or not serious about our studies or about books. We need to be serious. We all need to study hard and be serious. But at some point, we need to think about why we're studying so hard. And we need to kind of, like Ferdinand did, smell the flowers, you know? And I think that that's, again, kind of the lesson behind my book is that you go hard, go hard, go hard, and then breathe. So I think I would say that to any student, you know, who's out there studying is like, you know, do your work, get A's, be excellent, but then understand why you're studying and fall in love with the book that you're studying and really pursue those books. And again, be kind to yourself.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. And it's like when we're doing something, we should just go for it. But we also like pick ourselves a little bit out, like looking at ourselves from another angle, like abstract ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah. No, and I think it's true as parents too, right? You know, we want to do what's best for our kids, so we're going to do everything right. But at some point, we have to say, okay, I'm doing my best here, and now I'm going to, right? Right. I think we know that as parents too. It's like I'm not ever saying, hey, just anything goes. No, we are going to try to do the best for our kids. But at some point, we have to say, well, I did as good as I could today, and now tomorrow I'm going to try again, right?
That means more people should read the book Yes and No, and you can get out actually more things from the book more than the story itself.
Yeah. I think that in a way, maybe that is kind of the lesson behind this book is a little bit of kindness to ourselves.
Okay, I think that's pretty much about our talk for the podcast today.
Well, goodbye, audience, and thank you so much. This was a great talk, and thank you for listening and for reading my books.
Conversation with Elijah Cooper. If you would like to know more about him, you could check out his website in the show notes. And if you would like to listen to more of conversations with great authors and illustrators, don't forget to subscribe. I see you next time. Bye.